important set of connections that links the Islamic world to the various Turkmen tribes. And they pulled off, these Alliyads pulled off some successes. The most notable one was in 909, when one of these Alliyad pretenders who claimed to be a descendant of Fatima, the daughter of Muhammad, came out of hiding. He was a hidden imam. These are hidden prophets in the Shia tradition. And he organized the Berber populations of North Africa into a very, very effective tribal army. And Fatimid armies swept across North Africa. In 969, they entered the Nile Valley, occupied Egypt. The capital of the Fatimid caliphs is transferred to Cairo. They occupy Mecca and Medina, the holy cities. They take over the cities of the Levant, that is the eastern shore of the Mediterranean, and they establish a counter-caliphate. They are hailed by Shiites across the Islamic world, particularly one sectarian group, the Nizarites, who are better known by the name Assassins. They get that name from hashish because they're hit squads who are primarily aimed to take out Sunni rulers, emirs, and if they can, the caliph himself, were hyped up on hashish when they committed their assassinations. They hailed them, and they're located in remote mountain fortresses in Iran and elsewhere. The Fatimids, however, saw themselves very quickly as the rivals to the Abbasids. And to the disappointment of many of the extreme sectarians, the later Fatimid rulers at Cairo, caliphs at Cairo, we can call them Shia, or better yet, I think Aliyad is a better term, they saw themselves as the rival to Baghdad. And as a result, the caliph of Cairo and the caliph of Baghdad now disputed authority over the Islamic world. The Fatimids enjoyed a number of advantages. They had the holy cities. They entered into alliance with the Byzantine emperor, a resurgent Orthodox Byzantine state that was on the move against the Sunni emirs on their eastern frontier. And Baghdad looked in real trouble. Baghdad looked like its days were numbered, that a Fatimid army would cross the Fertile Crescent and occupy Baghdad and end the Abbasid caliphate in favor of a Shiite caliphate. But it didn't happen, because out of the steppes of Central Asia came a new people, Oyuz Turks, of the family of Seljuk. And these Turks, under their leader, Tuğrul Bey, entered the city of Baghdad in 1055, restored the power of the Abbasid caliph, attacked the Fatimids, and the Seljuk Turks would not only restore the power of the Abbasid caliph, but the power of Islam itself. And the role that they would come to play was a result of the interaction on that northeastern frontier between the caliphate and the Turkish tribes of the central steppes. And that is the next chapter in the history of the empires of the steppes.
Lecture 20, The Clash Between Turks and the Caliphate.
In this lecture, I want to address in more detail the initial contact between Islamic civilization and the people of the Central Eurasian steppes who were Turkish speakers. And this requires us to look at the conflicts, the wars waged between the early caliphs before the Abbasid caliphate came into power and eventually the Turkish tribes. This lecture will end on a rather peculiar battle in 751, the Battle of Talas, which is seen as a turning point in this relationship. It's a battle that evokes a lot of controversy and in some ways is remembered for the wrong reasons. But until we get to that battle, we need to explain how did the Islamic armies, largely Arabic-speaking at this point, come to fight a battle on a distant frontier, really on the borders of Kazakhstan today, close to the borders of the Tang Empire of China. Well, that gets us to the fact that the caliphs, the Rashidun, that is the first four caliphs, and the Umayyad caliphs ruling from Damascus down to 750, that these caliphs fell heir to the Sassanid Empire's northeastern frontier. And that was two issues. First was the region of Transoxiana, where the caravan cities are, and which were outside of the power of the Shah at the time of the Arab invasions. If you recall, those regions had fallen largely into the hands of Turkish tribes. That is, Turkish tribes that acknowledged the authority of the Khans of the Western Gurk Turks. These were generally subordinate tribes. The cities were ruled by different merchant princes speaking Sogdian and Tocharian languages. And so when the Arab armies had defeated the Shah's army, they had moved into Iran and they reached the Oxus frontier. At that point in 651, the Arabs were really at the limit of effective Sassanid power. And the river beyond was quite a different matter. It represented a whole different world, quite unusual, and a world that most Arabs would have found extremely unfamiliar. From the start, when the Arab armies reached the Oxus River, today the Amu Darya, they called the region to the north, Transoxiana, as those regions which were beyond the river. And that Arabic expression leads to the Islamic name for that region, which you find in later Islamic accounts, and it's known as Mawaranar, the area beyond the river. So from the very, very start, the Arab armies realized that this is a region that is not at all like what we are familiar with in the Byzantine and Roman world. Furthermore, the world beyond the Oxus represented a world that was very, very different to anything they had experienced in the Fertile Crescent. And we have to also adjust our perceptions of that world. This region, which we like to call Transoxiana, and I've tended to use that term because it's generally recognized by most Westerners, this region is usually thought of as the home of fabled cities, all sorts of silly orientalizing movies, nostalgia have been made about it, novels, a Samarkand. They conjure up images of great mosques and minarets. You have to delete all of that. The great monuments in Bukhara and Samarkand are really the work of the Samanid emirs, of whom we will speak later, and later still of the conqueror Tamerlane. Those did not exist. In 651, the Arabs looking across the Oxus saw a very, very different world. It was extremely diverse in its background. And some sense of this diversity has been captured by archaeology in the excavations of a town in Tajikistan, which is known as Panjikent. It's on the caravan route from Samarkand to Kashgar. And the city apparently sprang into action sometime in the 4th century AD and persisted into the 9th century AD. Excavations have revealed opulent houses of great merchant princes. The decorations indicate that clearly these occupants were familiar with Buddhism, Nestorian Christianity, Manichaeism. It is undoubtedly in villas such as these where Sogdian merchant princes welcomed Buddhist monks, the elect of the Manichaeans, where probably learned discussions took place. The objects that have been found in excavation indicated imported goods across the full extent of the Silk Road. And this one town, and the town goes into decline in the 9th century and is essentially abandoned, this one town is a glimpse into what all of the cities of Transoxiana and the Tarim Basin must have looked like on the eve of the Arabic conquest. There were Zoroastrian fire altars, Buddhist monasteries, the Vihara, places of worship for the Manichaeans, Nestorian churches, Jewish synagogues. It was a very diverse religious area. Furthermore, many languages were spoken in these cities, primarily the merchant languages of Sogdian, Aramaic, which was also the liturgical language of the Christians in these cities, and above all, Tocharian was still spoken. In fact, the region around Balkh, ancient Bactra was on the Oxus River. It was just outside of Arabic control initially. That area was known to the Arabs essentially as Tokharian land. They called it Tukharistan, indicating that that ancient Indo-European language was still spoken, and the majority of people there were Buddhists. This would be the kingdom where the great Bamiyan Buddhas were, which were destroyed by the Taliban extremists by blowing them up in a way to renounce the fact that many of their ancestors had once been Buddhists before the Arabic conquest. So this entire region was a formidable region for the Arabs to take on. There was no central imperial power to defeat. It wasn't convenient. You just didn't knock off the army of the Shah, and then a whole empire fell to you with its administrative apparatus. Same thing had happened in the Roman provinces in Syria, Egypt, and North Africa. There were a constellation of city-states beyond the Oxus, well beyond the knowledge of the Arabs in 651, was the great river, the Jaxartes. And the Jaxartes had been the boundary between Transoxiana and the nomadic peoples, and there dwelled various Turkish-speaking tribes. Turkish-speaking tribes that had long been in association with the cities of Transoxiana through caravan connections, trade connections. Many of the Turks had hired themselves out as guards to caravans. Others had served as ethnic regiments to the Sogdian merchant kings or the Tokharian princes who ruled the cities of Transoxiana. Within Transoxiana itself were settled smaller groups of nomads and clans and families who interacted with the agriculturalists in the cities, had worked out a very sophisticated pattern of life. And so Transoxiana was in many ways something of a urban extension of those central Eurasian steppes when the Arabs came on the scene. And the only reason the Arabs got to the Oxus River initially was they were afraid that the last Shah, Yazdegerd III, might rally support in the east and challenge Arab control of Mesopotamia and Syria. Well, that didn't happen. Once on that frontier, initially, the caliphs were not quite sure what to do with it. It wasn't until about 671 when a permanent camp was built at Merv. Merv is the old caravan city known as Margiane in classical sources. It represented the outpost of Arab power. And again, what was quartered there were three different Arab regiments, and these Arab regiments proved extremely unruly to keep them in line. And what happened is, very quickly, the Umayyad governors assigned to Merv kept their tribal regiments occupied by crossing the Oxus and raiding. And in the late 7th century and early 8th century, Arab forces crossed the Oxus at different points based at Merv, crossed into the cities of Transoxiana. They hit Balkh to the east on the upper Oxus. They went against the cities of Bukhara and Samarkand. Samarkand is probably the extreme end of their activities. None of these were permanent conquests. These were rather raids, massive raids, to pay the Arab tribal regiments. We have an account, for instance, of the looting that went on when an Arab force took the city of Bukhara in 709. The looting was unimaginable scale. The Arabs broke into the city. They sacked the Buddhist monasteries, damaged the stupa. But above all, they carried off enormous number of religious objects in silver and gold. And all of these riches were brought back to Merv, brought back to the Abbasid Empire. And many of the silver objects were actually melted down and coined into Sassanid-style dirhams, is the word, that is, silver coins that were used to pay these tribal armies. And that meant that the raids maintained a sort of security on the frontier, but there was no thought of conquest. There was no thought of actually bringing these regions within Dar al-Islam. It was rather a way of keeping your Arab regiments occupied. And the Umayyad caliphs grew suspicious because the governors commanding, and they had good reason, the governors commanding in Merv had enormous military power. They controlled some of the best Arab regiments in the empire. Furthermore, they recruited large numbers of Persians who served as the infantry. And these Persians were often given grants of land. They were converted to Islam. They were classified as Mawale. and serve side by side with the Arab tribal regiments. Now, the situation began to change at the opening of the 8th century. First, there was a powerful caliph on the throne by the name of Abd al-Malik. Abd al-Malik is really a pivotal caliph in the Umayyad dynasty. He rules from 685 to 705. He may have expended most of his efforts on trying to capture Constantinople, which failed, but he carries out the reorganization of the administration of the empire. And it is with him that the first Islamic coins are issued, where Arabic is made the administrative language of the empire. That is, Greek and Persian are no longer used. For the first three generations, you essentially using non-Arab bureaucrats. But above all, he carries out significant reorganization of the frontier provinces. Above all, that eastern province in Transoxiana. In 705, a new governor arrives there, a very important man, and his name is Qutaiba ibn Muslim. Qutaiba takes on the job of not only conducting raids, but he's given the go-ahead to begin the conquest north of the Oxus. And he's governor in Merv for some 10 years and launches a methodical set of campaigns that are not only intended to net loot to satisfy the Arab tribal regiments, but also to begin the conversion of the area. Now, to be sure, the attacks, to some extent, resembled earlier Arab attacks. They were attacks on livestock, on the pastures, the agricultural basis to the cities. And there's no doubt that the Arab tribesmen were intent on gaining loot. But there were also significant efforts on his part to convert the population. We have several reports, particularly in the city of Bukhara, when that city is captured by the armies of Qutaiba, that the great Buddhist mosque is leveled. The great Buddhist temple is leveled, and a Friday mass mosque is built there. That is a mosque for the Great Friday prayer. And furthermore, the locals are rounded up to attend the services. And the services were read out in Persian, not in Arabic, as in were probably a version of Sogdian. There are also anecdotes reported in later sources that soldiers were sent out into the countryside to round up the peasants so you had a proper congregation. Very often, these Arab soldiers were greeted by jeers and stones and refusals on the part of the local population to give up their ancestral religion and embrace this new faith. And so from 705 to 715, this governor, Qutaiba, tried to ram down Islam on the great caravan cities. Well, this provoked a reaction. In part, cities resisted far more seriously and fervently against the Arabs. And above all, they called in allies. And the obvious allies to call in were Turkish nomads. And this is where Arab armies and large Turkish tribal regiments begin to clash over the traditional battlefields of Transoxiana in the early 8th century. The man who responded to the call was a colorful figure. He's sometimes called a Khan. He more likely had a lesser title, is Yabgu Khan. And he is remembered in the sources as Suluk. He turned out to be a brilliant campaigner. And in the clashes between the Arab and Turkish armies, in the especially in the 720s, it becomes very, very clear on Transoxiana and on the steppes of Central Asia, the Turks can outride and outshoot the Arabs. And the Arabs have now run into a mounted opponent who can fight them to a draw. In fact, they could possibly outfight them. And between 718 and 722, Suluk reverses the situation. Many of the cities in Transoxiana that had submitted to Umayyad rule declared their independence or went over to the Turks. The Turks were seen actually more in the lines as allies, maybe not so much liberators, but at least a people that was understood in the caravan cities, with whom they had long dealings. Whereas to them, the Arabs represented the interlopers, bringing a new religion and attacking the various shrines and looting the various shrines in their cities. The result was, up until 722, the position was reversed and the Caliph's frontier essentially fell back to the Oxus. However, in 722, Seleuc was killed. The resistance to the Arabs fell apart, and the succeeding governors were not nearly as fervent as the previous one, and they begin to come to terms with the cities and begin a piecemeal conquest of Transoxiana, which within a generation, by 750, more or less delivers the great cities of Transoxiana to the control of the caliphs ruling in Damascus. Now, this was a different type of conquest. The very conquest of Transoxiana posed something of a religious crisis to the early Islamic community. When Muhammad had preached original jihad, a holy war, that led to the initial conquest of the first three generations, most of the areas that fell under the control of the Arabs, at least initially, most of those areas were occupied by Christians and Jews. Well, these people were dhimmi, people of the book. They were protected people. They did have prophets accepted in Islam. Christians and Jews would be tolerated in the true sense of the word from its Latin origin. They were suffered to exist. They were allowed to maintain their religious institutions, Christians and synagogues. They were no way treated as equals. That was not at all in the meaning of the word. They would be represented through their religious leaders. They had to wear certain dress. They could not ride horses. They were not supposed to practice the use of arms. They paid a head tax to practice their faith, which, of course, Muslims did not pay. There were a number of disabilities. On the other hand, the caliphs were more than content to leave their Christian and Jewish subjects unmolested. So long as they were loyal, there was no problem. By the conquest of Persia, the Arabs incorporated a region that was Zoroastrian, particularly Iran. There were some Christians in Persian Mesopotamia, but Iran was essentially a Zoroastrian world. This religion posed a bit of a problem. There really weren't any references to it in the Quran. In fact, Muhammad had probably no direct experience, really, with Zoroastrians. Well, already in the time of Abd al-Malik, it was clear that you had to come to some kind of accommodation with all these Persians. And so the Zoroastrians were now lumped together with Christians and Jews as protected people. Crossing the Oxus, however, especially starting in 705 and going down to 750, in that little over a generation, the battles across the traditional fields of Transoxiana, that brought into the power of the caliph all sorts of peoples who practiced religions with which the Arabs had absolutely no familiarity. Buddhism, Manichaeism, various pagan cults, Iranian cults. And in time, the Islamic government would have to come to terms with these groups as well, because many of them had surrendered on terms. And so by 750, Transoxiana was under the control of the caliph. It was hardly an Islamic land. And that is going to be a process we will examine in an up-and-coming lecture. Now, by 750, the armies of the caliph had reached the limits of their power, just about. They were now on the very, very western fringe of the power of the Tang emperors of China. And in July 751, a major battle took place between the armies of the caliph and the armies of the Tang emperor. When the battle took place, probably sometime in July, perhaps in August of 751, the main fighting was done by governors. The main Arabic governor was a fellow by the name of Ziyad ibn Salah. He had been an experienced governor. He was actually, in many ways, an appointment of Umayyad Caliphate. And when the battle was fought actually under the first Abbasid Caliph, that is As-Safra, who had overthrown the Umayyads. On the other hand, the Tang general, who represented the emperor, was a man by the name of Giao Jinyan Ji, a very experienced commander, a man who had ruled what the Chinese would call the western regions, Anxi, sometimes, It's an odd Chinese rendition of Arsacid, some vague memory of the fact that the Parthians may have once been in that vicinity. But it's the western regions of the Tarim Basin, which had been organized as the four garrisons by Tang armies back in the 650s and 660s. Both of these governors commanded important provincial armies, but both of them also depended very heavily on Turkish allies. Those were primarily Karluk Turks, a tribe of the Western Turkish Confederation, which were recruited by both sides. And the Karluk Turks, in the end, are going to decide the battle. How this battle came about was really a set of accidents. It was not planned. It was not part of a strategic design on the part of Baghdad to expand into the Tarim Basin. It certainly wasn't a effort on the part of the Tang Emperor to try to take back or try to expand into regions where once there was some kind of Han influence. Not at all. This was a dispute that actually blew up because client rulers of both great powers, in the complicated fighting that went on as the Arabs reasserted their authority in Fergana, resulted in exiles at the courts of the two governors. There was a ruler of Shashi, Tashkent today, who fled to Samarkand and appealed to Ziad, the Muslim governor, that he needed help to regain his throne. On the other hand, there were other refugees, Sogdian princes, who had come to the court of the Tang military governor, Jiao Jingyangji, with the same kind of appeals. They needed assistance to regain their thrones because their towns had been captured by the Arabs. And so it was really the appeal of these subordinate allies that drew the two imperial armies into a showdown. And both governors were not unaware of the strategic position of Transoxiana, particularly the Jaxartes Valley and Fergana, the source of all those wonderful horses. They were also quite aware of the importance of the trade routes and the strategic routes over the Pamirs. And so undoubtedly, as they assembled their armies, these were considerations for backing these clients. The idea was to put in power local rulers who would favor either the Tang Emperor or the Abbasid Caliph. So in 751, the armies moved into position to march, and they encountered each other at the Talas River. We have both Chinese and Arabic accounts of the battle. The best Islamic account comes from a much later source, from a fellow named Tabari, who's a Persian writer, but he based his accounts on eyewitnesses' accounts. He apparently read accounts by Arab generals who actually fought there. He drew upon earlier works no longer available. The Chinese were always very good at record keeping, especially in matters of statecraft and overall strategy. And the Chinese generals who fought in this battle, particularly the subordinate officers, as well as Giao Jinyanji, later wrote up memorandums to the emperor to explain what happened. This was customary in the Tang army. It's part of the collective knowledge of the Tang military to find out what went wrong and what can be corrected later. And this is classic within Tang military writing. So we have some sense of the size of each army. Now, the accounts, of course, exaggerate the size of the opponents. You know, the Chinese, in part, explain that we were just overwhelmed by numbers. And the Arabs say, well, we won despite the overwhelming Chinese numbers. Best guess is some 35 to 30,000 men were